This is a service of firsts. It is my first opportunity to speak to you during a regular Sunday morning service. And the theme which we have chosen to mull over this morning deals also with a first. The first chapter of the first book of our Bible. That richly poetic and compactly philosophic work, those few verses which we read this morning. Our rabbis held that these 34 lines of the Bible were, as it were, the chief pillars on which the Bible rests, embedded in the rock, in the substance of this text. They found the five philosophic or religious principles, the five affirmations of faith, which they held to be the essence, the quintessence of our Jewish outlook on life. In the beginning, God created. In Hebrew, but three short words, Bereshit bara Elohim. But these are the central pillar of our Jewish belief. God is all power. God is the power which can create. God is the power which has created this life. We are not here because of a chance juxtaposition of inorganic matter. Our lives are not purposeless. We are not at the mercy of chance. You will not find in the whole scheme of Jewish thought any pessimism, any fatalism, any throwing up of the hands, any feeling that our lives, our civilization is a worthless thing, something which has come into being by chance and can disappear from this earth equally quickly and equally by chance. Man was created for a purpose, and our purpose in life is to uncover the divine purpose and to make our lives fulfill his will. God is the creator. And God saw all that he had created, and behold, it was good. Here is the second of Judaism's fundamental assertions, the worthwhileness of life, and the assumption and the affirmation that life is given us to be enjoyed. Our eyes, the eyes of our teachers, of our rabbis and sages, have always been fixed on this world, not on the next, on the problems which face us in our daily living, and not on gaining for ourselves the secret combination to the lock that opens the kingdom of heaven. Life is good. Life is meant to be enjoyed. You will not find among our Jewish sages any feeling that we must repress and suppress our desires to enjoy the beauties and the love which abounds in this life. You will not find monasticism or asceticism among the principles of our faith. Life is good. There is no fatalism among our people. We are optimistic about the future. We feel that this is a good earth, and with our hands and our minds working to make it better, it can become a better place in which to live. And because we are optimistic about the future, our faith has always concerned itself with the questions of the marketplace, has always concerned itself with the prophetic imperative, with winning for our people, for all people, social justice, equality of opportunity, a right to share equally in the bounties which this world has to offer. And God created man. Here is the third fundamental assumption and affirmation of Judaism. God created man singly, alone, soul. He created man, the rabbi said, singly to teach us all a lesson. to teach us that there are no inferior races and no superior races, no inferior peoples and no superior peoples, to teach us that each man, each country, each person, whatever his skin, whatever his color, whatever his nationality, is equally the son of God, equally the son and descendant of the first man, equally deserving of his share of this earth's bounty. And because all men are brothers, we have imposed upon us as Jews an overwhelming obligation to work in all causes, whether they be civic or communal or national or international, which have to do with the betterment of the lot of all of our brothers. And God created man, and he created man in his own image, after his own likeness created he him. Here is Judaism's fourth major assumption, the affirmation that we are not simply frail flesh, that we are not an empty vessel, that we have more than enough potential and talent and capacity within us to become more than the beast, more than the animal, close to the God who created us. Judaism assumes that in each of us there is a spark of the divine, and that life consists, our duty in life consists in fanning this spark into a flame, in maturing, in realizing our talents, in realizing our capacities, in making use of the wonderful mental and emotional gifts which God has placed in us. Judaism does not teach that we have acquired some taint of original sin, that we are so weak and so fragile that we can achieve nothing. On the contrary, it teaches us that we are powerful, that we are co-workers with God in the work of his creation. And finally, God rested on the seventh day. God rested on the seventh day and hallowed it. This too is a fundamental assumption of our people. In the days in which the Bible was written, 90% of mankind was enslaved. There was no thought given to their inner needs, to their leisure, to their own human needs and human desires. They were worked without thought of their basic human rights. And when the Bible enunciated the right of each and every man for a day for himself, this was a challenging moral and social assumption. This was part of the prophetic crusade of our people. Now today, this doctrine of the one day in seven of rest hardly seems shocking, hardly seems forward-looking. We have another problem. Our problem is that we have too much leisure. Our problem is to use constructively the leisure at our hands. And yet this assumption remains, that Judaism is concerned with every legitimate program for the betterment of the common lot. That Judaism is concerned with the welfare and the well-being of each and every man who toils here on this earth. That the pulpit and the temple is not above, beyond, superior to the problems of everyday life. That though it concerns itself with matters spiritual, its ultimate end is to concern itself and to improve the material lot of man. And our fifth principle comes from the text that God saw all that he had created. Behold, it was good. Behold, it was good. The good earth. And the rabbis say that the cornerstone of Judaism is to be found in this first chapter of our Bible. Here in the very first 34 lines of text are to be found the basic principles within which all later Jewish thought operates. But somehow, in the last century, men seem to have found that this cornerstone of Judaism is chipped and is cracked. They seem to feel that the text of the first chapter of Genesis is no longer the magnificent moral and spiritual challenge which it has always felt to be. Why is this so? The first chapter of Genesis tells us that God created this earth in 6 days. The new knowledge in biology and in geology has piled up overwhelming and incontrovertible evidence that man, for instance, did not come into being until after some billions of years of life had passed. The timetable of the first chapter of Genesis is misinformed, is fallacious, is erroneous. And secondly, as you read the first chapter of Genesis, you cannot help but feel that whoever was its author held to the view that each species was created singly and separately. God created the trees, then he created the reptiles, then he created the fish, then he created the mammals, then he created man. There is no necessary interconnection between each of these species. But again, the science of biology has told us that there is an interconnection between the simpler and less complex organisms and the higher and more intricate organisms, even between the simplest amoeba and man. Man has in his family tree not only some primitive form of the ape, but also mammals and reptiles and amphibians and the fish that inhabit the sea and even simpler organisms. There is a chain in life between all that lives. They are all part of one family. And because men found that some of the scientific detail of the first chapter of Genesis was fallacious, they came to question its whole basic purpose and meaning. Now, had they found such errors, say in Shakespeare, had they found that Shakespeare's geography or his anatomy was an error, they would simply have said, well, you cannot expect Shakespeare to have known more about science than was known in his day. After all, it is his consummate artistry, his mastery of the English language, his poetic genius, his art, which endears him to us and makes him eternally worthwhile. But you cannot say that, some men felt about the Bible. You cannot simply shrug your shoulders and say, well, the Bible was wrong in this and this detail. Because to many, the Bible was more than simply a work of art, a masterpiece. It was a holy book. It was the revealed word of God. Men asked themselves, how can God be wrong? How could God have revealed to us facts which are in error and which are fallacious? Surely God must know all that there is to know. Surely he would not have committed error in revealing his word to his chosen people. So men were troubled. For the century since Darwin first published his Origin of Species, there has been a quiet battle in the minds of men to reorient their position on the worthwhileness of the Bible. Some men threw out the baby with the bath. Some men said that because the Bible is in error as to detail, it is completely worthless. Let us toss it aside. It is not necessary to the modern day. And some men tried to live their lives with blinkers. Some men said that if science is in error, is in opposition to the Bible, science is in error. Science must be wrong. And they simply refused to admit the overwhelming mass of evidence as to natural selection and mutation and as to the laws of heredity. Now there is, of course, a middle way. It is the Jewish way. It is the way that holds that all truth is one. And it is simply that we are slowly gaining an awareness of the truth along many ways. It is the way of the old Midrash. It is the way which sought not the superficial meaning of a biblical text, but the gold ore which is buried deep within and which can be understood only when we apply ourselves in our minds to understanding its fullest import. But many men were not prepared for the way of the Midrash, and the battle has raged for 100 years in public debate and in private meditation as to the meaning and purpose of our Bible. Now, this debate took many forms, and it was an honest debate and an open debate until the men of one side were finally driven so much into a corner, finally had so many of their arguments opposed by facts which they could not controvert, that they resorted, as do all too often men, believing that they have a noble cause, but believing that their cause is challenged by some new fact, they resorted to coercion. In March of 1925, the legislature of the state of Kentucky declared it to be a crime to teach the doctrine of evolution in any state-supported institution. In March of 1925, the legislators of the state of Kentucky, prompted by sincere Bible-believing people, by church-going men and women, by good men and women, declared it to be a crime to teach what was believed by the scientists of their day to be scientific fact. Now, I suppose that men have a right to any opinion, however misguided, however lacking in substance and in basis. But I am sure of this, that no man and no group of men has a right to attempt to coerce others into their belief. And no man or group of men has a right to deny to the world facts which cast doubt upon their chosen and cherished tenets. The citizens of Kentucky who created this law were among a long skein of honest, well-meaning, well-intentioned, but erroneous people who, since the days of old, have attempted to silence the questioner, silence the doubter in the name of some higher good. After all, it was well-intentioned people who ordered that Socrates drink the cup of hemlock because he cast doubt on the gods of Athens. It was honest, temple-going people who ordered that Jeremiah be cast into chains and made Jeremiah in daily peril of his life because he dared to assume that the temple was not inviolate, that if the people did not change their ways, God, the God even of the Jews, would wreak havoc upon his chosen people. It was honest, well-meaning churchgoers who burned the Brunos and silenced the Galileos, who created the Index, who have in all ages attempted to create religious censorship, have attempted to deny to the young, to deny to the mind which is grasping and seeking and thinking, a right to have presented to it for acceptance or rejection all facts which might bear on an issue. Now in 1925, when the state legislature of Kentucky passed this law, this debate for the minds of men took on a much more sinister tone. It was no longer a question of individual belief. It was a question whether the United States, built and based on freedom, was to gain for all of its citizens the freedom of dissemination of information, the freedom to teach, and the freedom to learn. In 1925, this law became a cause célèbre. In the little town of Dayton, a young biology teacher by the name of Scopes challenged this law, made a test case of the law, and to his side rushed Clarence Darrow, the giant legal mind of this generation, all the organizations dedicated to civil liberties. They were determined to overthrow this law and to reassert America's fundamental beliefs in the freedom of information, the freedom of the human being to think and to make up his own mind. The trial was a dramatic one. For the opposition, for the well-meaning and well-intentioned Bible believer, there was William Jennings Bryan, the great commoner, the greatest orator of his day, 4 times candidate for the presidency of the United States, a man who perhaps more than any other was able to verbalize and vocalize the sentiments and the feelings of the average American. these two giants met in a dramatic clash. And the story of this clash has been retold for us in the play of Lawrence and Lee, which came to Cleveland last week, Inherit the Wind. These two authors have well captured the essential point at issue, the fact that this was a struggle for the freedom of the human mind. And they have shown dramatically how Darrow, Drummond in the play, won for his client, won before the bar of American opinion, reasserted the basic American love of freedom, and saw to it that the censorship, because of religious loyalties, was not to be imposed upon our religious school system. The question as to the place that the Bible is to play in our own minds remained moot. America was awakened, perhaps more than she had ever been before, to the necessity of deciding once again what the Bible was, how the Bible should be treated. Was it a holy book to be swallowed whole? Was it plenarily inspired by God, each sentence, each word directly revealed by him to men? Or was it no more than any other book, any of the hundreds of thousands of books which pour out of our presses each year? Was it perhaps a dangerous book, such a book which could inspire men to all types of excesses in its name? I would suggest to you that there is an answer, a wonderful answer to the place the Bible should play in our minds. It is the Jewish answer. It is the answer which Judaism has maintained for, lo, 3,000s of years. It is an answer based on the Midrash and based on the Jewish assumption that all truth is one, that religion and science are but the obverse and the reverse of a single coin. The Midrash, the rabbis, sought to read the Bible not for what it said on the surface, but what it said deep within. They saw that the inspiration, the grandeur of the Bible, its revealed nature, if you will, was the fact that in 34 such lines as the first chapter of Genesis, a writer and author could compact a whole way of life, a whole philosophy. This was the miracle of the Bible. And nowhere in Jewish life will you find any opposition to new science, to new learning. In fact, whenever an observant Jew sees a great mind, whether he be Jew or Gentile, he is asked by our people to say, "Blessed art thou, O Lord our God, King of the universe, who has created discernment and wisdom." It is a positive commandment, a mitzvah, to search out the heavens, to learn astronomy, and to search out the human body, to learn anatomy. Judaism has always sponsored and fostered the study of the sciences. And you can search Jewish history, and you will not find a single attempt to create an index, a single attempt to impose a rigid or any type of scientific censorship. How can this be? We too have an orthodoxy. We too have men who believe that the world was created 5,716 years ago. But these men long since have been used to this midrashic method. And when the scientists said that the details of the first chapter of Genesis show the limited state of scientific knowledge 25 or 300 years ago, our rabbis were quite prepared to say, "Well, after all, the days mentioned in Genesis are perhaps epochs. We cannot measure them. They represent whole generations, decades, centuries of years." Look how close, they pointed, is the story of the progressive evolution of men and of animals as told in Genesis, the story which Darwin and his successors paint for us. As modern Jews, we would reject this symbolism. We would point out to the fact that the Bible author did not know the theory of evolution, made mistakes, if we are to assume that he did, in the nature of evolution. But we too would point to the ethical insights, the moral imperatives deep in the bedrock of this chapter. We too would say that this is a great chapter, limited surely, limited by the knowledge of his day, but great with the eternal knowledge, which is the knowledge of the human being, of the nature and the relationship of the human being to God, and of the nature of God. Science tells us how the world was formed. Religion tells us how life is to be reformed. Science tells us about the use that man can make of nature. Religion tells us of the use man should make of his character and of his talents. They deal with separate fields. They are not contradictory, but complementary. And I do not know whether Lawrence and Lee, the authors of Inherit the Wind, were Jewish or not. But they came to a Jewish answer when, at the very end of the play, after all the antagonists and the protagonists have left the stage, Drummond stands there alone. They make Drummond pick up his copy of Darwin's Origin of the Species and look at it, and then walk over to the desk of the clerk of the courts, and pick up the Bible and look at it, and then bring both books together and bind them in a single parcel for reading on the train. Both books are worth reading. Both are necessary to the development of man. Without religion, science can only speed the destruction of men. Without science, religion is incapable of improving the material lot of men. Each is necessary to the other. And as it is said in the book of Ecclesiastes, Tov she'te'echoz bazeh, v'gam bizeh al tanach yadcha. It is good that you should take hold of this point of view, and also from this point of view, not take away your hand. Let us take both these books, both science and religion, both faith and the facts of nature. Let us learn them, let us absorb them, and let us use them wisely. The Bible will reveal to us how men should live. Science will reveal to us the use man can make of the nature and of the power which surrounds him. There's a great future which both evolution and the Bible put before men. Evolution tells us that we are growing in strength, growing in our capacity to respond to our environment, that each generation is, in a sense, a little bit more adept at being human than the previous. Religion paints for us the glorious future of peace and well-being among men. The glorious future in which men have learned to share with one another the glories and the bounties of nature. When the right of every man shall be to dwell under his vine and under his fig tree, for none need be afraid. Both these disciplines paint for us a glorious future. And if we use both these disciplines and use them wisely, truly we can make a glorious future for all men. Amen.